See, get over it. Maybe we're all naked on the internet, but does that give people the right to stare at us or to dredge the web for questions in this confirmation process before you sit on the Supreme Court? Connection listeners, would you know how to search the web for stuff on me or where I'd find stuff about you? Our phone is 1-800-423-8255. Our guests teach the Harvard Law School course on privacy and the internet. It's a course that's available only on the web. Jonathan Zittrain runs the Berkman Center for Internet and Society. Wendy Seltzer is a third-year law student who designed the software for the course and co-teaches it. If they could find your shoe size, or your shoplifting arrest record, or your fascination with Pamela Anderson from the web, connection listeners, what should they be able to do with that information? Give them a call at 1-800-423-TALK. Jonathan Zittrain, what can you find from the web about me, about you, about anybody?
Well, let's assume we have somebody who was just nominated to the Supreme Court, thrust into the public spotlight all of a sudden, and people, of course, are then really curious about anything they can find out about them. So I'll give the best scare scenario I can, given the current internet or the one that's just around the corner. First of all, one thing you could do is find out anywhere that they have been quoted in any magazine. And if you're willing to pay a little bit of money, you can find any time they've been quoted in the past 10 or 15 years, quoted or discussed. So certainly for a nominee, anything they've said, maybe it was 15 years ago when they were doing something that they regret now or they feel differently about or for which they simply gave an offhand quote to a reporter, it's now there and in the record and findable through a simple search. Second, they're going to find out where you live. They'll find out your telephone number. They'll probably find out who your kids are. They may be able pretty quickly to make a good estimate as to where they go to school, what hours the school is open, and when they could be expected to be found. They might know what...
Well, that sounds pretty standard. We could find a lot of that today. But what if through the net you found somebody's Social Security number? Would that open a new realm of sort of personal stuff?
It might. It might open a new realm in the sense that it'd give you another hook into records that you could search. Of course, some of those databases are going to be databases that are only for the initiated, which means you're either going to pay some money or know the person that has the handle on the database in order to search it. With it, though, something like a Social Security number, which also often doubles as a driver's license number, you will be able to find then exactly what cars they have licensed, where they might be licensed, whether they've ever had conviction of some kind, anything from murder on down to some kind of unpaid traffic tickets, that kind of thing. Now, somewhere there reposes on the web information about where that person has been surfing and what they've been doing. Now, whether that information is searchable by someone is another question, but it's out there, which means if you answered a CNN.com poll on what you thought about, oh, I don't know, abortion, that click may well have been recorded in a way that could eventually be traceable back to you. And if CNN should choose or in some way leak that information, it would then be connectable back up to you. What you've been reading, browsing, purchasing, those kinds of things, so long as you've been doing it on the web, again, are events for which the storage is so cheap and the processing power, right, and actually on the search is so cheap that to some of us it does seem almost inevitability.
Reporters used to do things like that. I mean, with J. Edgar Hoover or Henry Kissinger, they would actually go out and, you know, go through their trash cans and find out, you know, cereal, you know, whether they ate green bananas or not, all sorts of silly or potentially embarrassing stuff. If you can empty all the trash cans on the net, email, for example, turn them upside down on our nominee, what are you going to find?
Well, I'd find if I were actually able through some way to get into their email account or something, to particularly saying they use a free email account, one that's through the web, I'd be able to find their email, which is to say things they've been sent and received, going back as far as they've asked to keep it in the bucket. If the company makes backup tapes, for instance, let me assume for a moment that I have subpoena power of some kind. So I'm not going to worry yet about whether the person holding the data is going to tell me no if I want to see it. I'm holding a subpoena, waving it around, and with it then, I might be able to get backup tapes that have email 5-10 years old that somebody squirreled away on a dusty shelf that they could then pull off and say, okay, here's what this person has been up to, here's what they've been saying, here's what their grandma wrote them most recently. Are you sure you really want to see this?
What do you suppose the rules are in the Senate Judiciary Committee about the admissibility of this stuff? say you have it. Say you haven't broken any law getting it. And it turns out that this person has, you know, three mistresses or has, let's say, a kind of membership, a fetish, a fascination in correspondence that he wouldn't want to talk about. When does it become usable, admissible, off the record usable in this, you know, well, at some point you take somebody aside and say this may not be worth it?
I think the practical answer to the question has got to be, certainly in light of the past year's events, that if it is out there, you've got to assume it is going to come to light. And if it's not going to come to light because it has been properly admitted before the committee with somebody testifying to its authenticity, it's going to get to Matt Drudge. It's going to be all over the web through something like the Drudge Report, or even an anonymous email will circulate around with these allegations that can never quite properly be tied back to the person leaking the information. And then before you know it, the mainstream media, in order to keep up, is going to have to report it. So I think there's definitely a sense that if the information is there, you've got to assume it's going to come out. And then such a question, do you want them to be, whoever your opponents may be, the ones putting it out? Or should you preemptively say, okay, here's the list of sins that I can remember, at least think of. Please, somebody refresh my memory on anything else. And I humbly submit myself to your consideration.
Wendy Seltzer, what's your worst nightmare about the kind of information that could come out? And then what's your general thinking about ways it ought to be controlled? By law, by technology, by sort of political convention, or what?
Well, the information is just a chain of materials that links everything that I've done online on my computer. We start to see cases where things that I've done just on the computer, documents I've written, sent as an attachment by email. Somebody gets one of those and can trace the Microsoft serial number we now have that might have imprinted itself in my Word document, then connects that document to the collection of things that I've done. They see that the same person who wrote that has been browsing on various websites. It's the fact that all of this information stays with me, that I can't put behind me the fact that I visited some porn sites, some indecent sites.
It reminds me, you know, it's as if suddenly, you know, every conversation you've had in the subway or at the diner or at a dinner party is suddenly recoverable. Every, you know, every jest, every inquiry, every silly question, every digression, every bit of banter is suddenly, potentially at least, recoverable.
And the difficulty is that I can't move to another state and get away from it. I can't change communities and meet a new group of people who won't be able to get back to, or won't be able to get back easily to what I've done in the past.
Is the remedy, first of all, do we need a remedy, and should it be in the way the machinery is built, in the law that governs the use of it, or in some sort of political understanding that this stuff won't come before the Senate?
I think it needs to be in a combination. Because, as you were just saying, even if the law isn't allowing these things into evidence in the formal proceeding, they come out and suddenly the nomination is withdrawn for other reasons. Maybe the scandal isn't brought up as the reason, but it's in the background. So I think that we need some technological ways of thinking about erasing this memory, that there are times we just don't need to keep the backup tapes. So we should burn them, we should erase them, we should clean them off.
Can it be done?
Sure, there are programs. I mean, it has to be done consciously. You need to take your old backup tapes and reformat them, write over the data. Otherwise, things can be recovered even from backup tapes that have been forgotten.
Jonathan, is there a technological fix for this?
Yes. It's funny, you said something about every conversation, every chat, every jest. To me, that's actually quite prescient, because the next thing after cheap processors and cheap storage that I already mentioned is cheap sensors. That's what's right around the corner. By cheap sensors, I mean video cameras, microphones, the wiring to hook them up to the web that are sufficiently cheap that you can just have them there, have them basically ubiquitous, and with it be feeding a lot of the information that would otherwise go unnoticed right onto the web and store it. The technological fix, though, would be not to even store it to begin with, rather than to store it and then hope that in some way it's going to get erased. Against all of that, though, by the way, is the deadbeat dad problem. There's not a single database for which you wouldn't want to search it at some point to find a deadbeat dad. you're telling me that in that Mass Pike toll booth collecting database, or the New Jersey Turnpike, when you go through the bin, it actually records your car's serial number. If that's a way to track down a deadbeat dad, and you're telling me in 5 seconds I could tell you if that guy had moved to New Jersey, who wouldn't want to know that?
Well, I'm not sure we would want to know it. Particularly, you know, the dads of the world, and they're getting very well organized now, will tell you that this is a misnomer, deadbeat dads. These are dustbin dads. These are dads that have, that's a good example, because the choice of deadbeat dad as a sort of social undesirable is itself enormously arguable. Would you apply that kind of tracing technology to that category of people?
Well, that's a good point. I suppose I could always come up with a hypothetical person who's done something sufficiently terrible that you really want to find them. And that way it just becomes too irresistible not to search the database for it. And the person making the decision of whether to search, in this case we're talking about the authorities, not just people walking around, but some kind of enforcement agency or something, they're going to make the decision to issue the subpoena and try to search the database.
You guys teach this course on Internet privacy, but Scott Mignetti says, you know, get over it. It's history. We'll never have it again. Do you come down on that? I mean, have you decided it's over or not? Is it recoverable? Is there such a thing as privacy and the Internet?
Well, I'm hoping that the law will be able to shape the technology in such a way as to give us back some of the privacy that we seem to be losing to the technology that's surrounding us.
Can it exist together, Jonathan?
I think they can. Part of the problem is to know what you don't know. I mean, a lot of the idea when you surf the web is it's not a completely transparent connection on what you're doing. So you don't know exactly who might be listening or what the people on the other end of your connection are going to do with the data that they're gathering. So that makes it very difficult from an enforcement point of view to actually find out what's being collected, where it is reposing, and how to eliminate it. And the kind of schemes that you imagine, short of the technical, where you just know the software has been designed so that it just won't capture it, when you think of regulatory regimes, law regimes, it has to be very intrusive to actually march into the company and say, all right, we want to inspect your hard drive and see what you've really been collecting on people.
We're talking about privacy and the Internet. The phone's 1-800-423-8255. Do you know how public your surfing is and has been for years now? Should your privacy be better protected in the design of the machines, in the law about what can be made available? 1-800-423-TALK makes the Internet privacy connection. Jason Catlett is on the line from New Jersey. He runs Junk Busters, and he's been beating up in the papers lately on Microsoft in connection with this tracer bullet that goes with everything you use in your Windows. Jason Catlett, what could that serial number on your software and all the uses of it, what could it be used for? What's the danger that you worry about?
The basic danger is that a document that you wrote that you thought was anonymous can in fact be traced back to you. And let me give you an example of
what if you thought it was not anonymous but just private? I mean, a MASH note or a political statement.
If you wrote a letter on Microsoft Word 98 and included that, put that on a website or sent it to somebody, the invisible serial number, or as Microsoft call it, global user identifier, which was contained in that nobody knew about in the public until about 2 weeks ago, that number can be traced back to your PC. And discussing government investigators, this is the ideal tool for phishing tackle, for phishing expeditions by these investigators, and indeed in any civil case. It's possible once you get the hardware identifier from a document that you were known to author, then the investigator or the litigant can require a company to run a program and trawl through its file server or its records looking for other documents that also contain that same identifier. So even a spreadsheet or a PowerPoint demonstration which doesn't have your name can turn up and be evidentially associated with you because of this secret identifier. So it's an example.
Evidence for whom? You know, are we talking about in court? Are we talking about in Matt Drudge's report, in just sort of neighborhood rumor, or what?
Any of those. It could be an email that got around through people forwarding it. It could be an email that a Word document that somebody put on the web that you thought didn't have your name in it because you removed it before that, but it's got the secret identifier in it. It's only been known for 2 weeks that Microsoft has been doing this for months. And by now there are probably hundreds of millions, perhaps billions of documents that have been created that contain this secret identifier. And Microsoft's reaction has been to say, oh, well, we'll publish a utility that removes it. Well, that's no good if people don't know about it. And we really think that there's a lot of cleanup to be done before people can rid themselves of the risks that Microsoft has put them on.
Now, I actually credit that there's no ill motive, or there doesn't have to have been an ill motive by Microsoft or some privacy-invading motive to have put in this identifier. They may actually have thought it a convenient feature, much as the Intel Pentium 3 chip thought it convenient to go ahead and have a serial number on each chip that could be broadcast over the web to make transactions more secure. But I think what we're realizing is that these things have so many different uses, and later when you go in and do this backfill, indeed you could do the search. Another example is as people shift away from dial-up connections, actually having to dial a phone and make a temporary connection to the internet in order to surf, they shift away from that into cable modems and other technologies that have them permanently on the internet. That actually gives them a permanent point of presence that may well identify them. Media One, for example, one of the cable companies, as a default, they assume when you sign on with a permanent internet connection that the identifier you want for your point of presence is your last name, .mediaone.net. And when you surf around, you are then handing out your last name on every single mouse click you give. Now, it doesn't have to be that way, and again, I don't think that they intended anything terrible by it, but it's exactly this category of stuff that goes unnoticed, it's hard to understand, and it could amount to a fairly significant invasion of privacy.
Yeah, Jonathan's point about the question of intention is an important one. Microsoft certainly has come up with plausible reasons for wanting that technical feature, but when pressed, they haven't given any example of how it's being used by them or anyone else. Microsoft have also stated that they were unaware that this feature has been included, and that they never intended to link it, as they indeed can, with their marketing databases when people register for Microsoft software. There's a long chain of denials here, and many independent commentators, analysts, media people have drawn a comparison with President Clinton's I Didn't Inhale defense, that it really lacks credibility, particularly when these companies have such strong motivations to track people down for the purpose of copyright infringement.
Jason Todd, draw back to the general hypothesis, or the hypothetical notion here that you've been nominated to the Supreme Court and suddenly everybody's searching the web, legally, illegally, maybe paying, maybe not, maybe with a little government help, maybe with some big corporation or banks network. What might they find out about you, about me? What worries you most about privacy out there?
Well, if I were nominated tomorrow, and this is impossible because I know you're a citizen, but what they would be able to find now is already pretty extensive. We actually did this exercise at an Internet World Conference with a woman who led a rather unremarkable life. They had a team of four professional investigators at this panel who had spent 24 hours getting every piece of dirt they could on her, and it went down to the names of her pets, professional society memberships. This poor woman sat there for an hour while a huge amount of her life was poured out in front of her, and she was deeply shocked by the extent of that. There was actually nothing at all embarrassing. This woman seems to have led an exemplary life. But the extent of the details were such as to make you cringe.
It's a very interesting question, because some people would be more embarrassed to have their, you know, their pet names revealed, or their alternative names, or their cuddly names, or the crazy things they call their pets in the middle of the night, or whatever. That would be somehow more intrusive, more revealing than who they voted for in 1964 for president.
In many ways, people object to that soft data, particularly when it's made inferentially, than to hard facts like you applied for a credit card on the 14th of January. And I think we have to step back for a minute and look at what this kind of surveillance is doing for our society and for our psyches. If people grow up, as children are now, with the belief that nothing that they do can possibly be private, then that changes their view of themselves in an enormous way that we really can't begin to understand. If we have a society where surveillance is the norm, where we all believe the slightest transgression will be shouted from the rooftops, then we will behave differently, and ourselves will be very different, and in some ways we will be reluctant to grow and to find who we are for fear of that someone else might find that out before us.
Interesting question. Jason Catlett, stand by if you would for callers. We're talking about privacy and the internet, if indeed they're not a contradiction in terms. 1-800-423-8255. Julian is on the line.
Hi.
Hello, Julian.
Hi, I'm an investigative TV producer. I freelance for Canadian television, and I run a website called JournalismNet, and I train journalists on how to spy on people on the net as part of our legitimate journalistic work.
Tell us all.
Well, I'll give you one. You're just talking about what's available in the future, but right now I went onto the website of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society.
Uh-oh.
And there are some web addresses, email addresses to contact people. So a lot of them use an address, a web email address, which is law@law.harvard.edu. Well, if you go to Deja News, which is the repository of all the messages people have posted on chat groups, Deja News stores already a quarter of a billion messages. You put in that email address, and I found over 10,000 messages from students or professors that they have posted in all kinds of discussion groups.
So what's Wendy Seltzer really like?
So there's one person I'm looking at right now. He has posted something like 2,000 messages, and I can track everything he said here, say, on a discussion group about drugs.
You wonder when he does any studying.
That's right. Or you may be a professor. I can try to find out more about him. The people don't realize that you could be in a knitting chat group, a quite legitimate knitting chat group, and people know these are public posts, but they don't realize that by just clicking on the author posting history, you could find everything else they have been posting in these public groups. Now, there's no expectation of privacy in these public groups, but for journalists, for investigative journalists, this is a gold mine in terms of trying to find if people are legitimate, if they're hiding something. I've talked to private detectives who use this, skip tracers, who use this to find people who have been on the run. And I suppose my question is how your two guests think this is changing and the challenges this poses for journalism.
Interesting question. Wendy?
Well, one of the challenges for journalists is figuring out how much of this is public and private in terms of how much people deserve to be able to keep private. And we look at public figure doctrine in libel, where if someone has made himself or herself a public figure by doing something to catch the public eye, he or she expects more exposure and gives the journalist more latitude.
Well, I think Julian's talking about, you know, journalists not publishing this information raw. That's sort of it's the start of a conversation. Yeah, that was an interesting observation you made in the knitting chat group about, a particular stitch, or I mean, I don't know what in the world they would talk about, but it's just sort of an opening gambit, and the first reaction from the subject is, holy mackerel, you know that about me?
Well, I published an article where we traced in one of the training courses, it's very easy to find what the main address is for any government civil servant, depending what department he or she is working in. And we showed how one civil servant had one government functionary had sent 250 messages to a Christian evangelical chat group. So aside from the point of what was he or she doing on public time, it reveals how much you can find out about people. One of the challenges that I think is interesting is that the reverse also works for journalists. You can spy on what journalists from the Washington Post or NPR or any other TV station or newspaper, what questions they're asking in chat groups. Mm. Companies track this to see what...
Jason Catlett, I know we got to let you go to break. Does this trouble you?
Yeah, but I think we can't shoot the messenger here. I don't think we should blame journalists for reporting information that is available.
And, I agree.
With the internet now, everybody is a publisher.
Got to take a break. Maybe stand by, Jason Catlett. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. We're funded by the listeners of WBUR Boston and by Anderson Consulting, a global management and technology consulting organization that helps its clients change to be more successful, on the web at ac.com, and by Dice, with thousands of IT jobs in Boston and nationwide for programmers, software engineers, and other computer professionals, high-tech jobs and opportunities from across the country appear on the web at dice.com. From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up in the second hour of The Connection with Christopher Lydon, the author of Pictures of Innocence, The History and Crisis of Ideal Childhood. In the 90s, our images are changing once again, and we shelter our youngsters like hothouse flowers, according to the author, and see erotic subtext in Calvin Klein underwear ads. That's all in hour number two of The Connection with Chris Lydon at 11 o'clock. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Splash Kitchen and Bath Showroom, with over 10,000 square feet of display area, prominently featuring the bold look of Kohler at 800-696-6662. And by Schneider Leasing Company, providing computer and leasing solutions throughout New England for more than 15 years. The rain will develop in the early afternoon. We've got a high today of 45 to 50 degrees. Rain ending early tonight, partial clearing after midnight, and then tomorrow partly sunny with a high of 45 to 50. Currently, rain is imminent under heavy clouds, and the temperature reading is 40 degrees. WBUR supporters include Barnes & Noble at Boston University, hosting George Stephanopoulos discussing his book, All Too Human, A Political Education, on April 6th at 7 p.m. at the Tsai Performance Center, no tickets needed. And by AccuNet, featuring 56K dial-up services, dedicated high-speed access, and website hosting services throughout Massachusetts. 508-490-7610. It's 10:35.
I'm Michael Goldfarb. Join me at the BBC Brunch Sunday, April 11th at the Providence Biltmore Hotel. Mark Leahy and Ravi Omar, both defense correspondents for the BBC, plus NewsHour anchor Max Pearson will be there to answer questions and bring their unique perspective on world events. Tickets to benefit WBUR are $75. Reserve your tickets for the BBC Brunch at 1-800-909-9287.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection, the privacy on the internet connection. On the internet, where we all seem to be transparent, we all seem to be x-rayable already. Is there any recovery possible of privacy on the net? Jason Catlett, just before the break, the caller was pointing out all the things that are easily recoverable already. What would you do about it?
Well, I think we need two things to happen. We need for society to realize that a totally transparent
society where your every move is tracked and available to everyone is not the way that we want to go. And there are people who claim, notably David Brin, a science fiction author, that this is actually the way we want to go, because it solves the deadbeat dad problem in the large, in the sense that it makes everybody accountable. I don't accept that argument. I think privacy is something that people want and need in order for us to grow as a society and to be free. But so assuming that we want to have a private society, what are we going to do about it? If we just let the technologists march on and do what is good for their business models, then we are not going to get any privacy. If we leave it up to the government investigators who simply want to prosecute every single crime that to the maximum extent possible, we're not going to get any privacy. What we need are laws to protect private information and technology that increases anonymity rather than reducing it. That's what I think we need.
Well said. Jonathan Zittrain, do you want to comment?
Sure.
I'll
in some ways try to offer part of what David Brin's view would be. It's true. He says, accept it, deal with it. It's a transparent society, much like the Scott McNeely quotation you gave, Chris. Of course, part of his point is that the people in power are going to be doing this anyway, no matter what you do, just expect it. So why shouldn't you at least level the playing field? If you have an opportunity to watch the watchers, if you imagine such ubiquitous sensors and massive storage and searching, at least you can be there and look at this police dispatcher and just see how she's acting as she dispatches the riot squad, and you end up with a more, as he said, accountable society. So that's one reason. The other thing is, you do want to have some control over what people can do with private information. There's a website out there, for example, called the Nuremberg Files. This got a lot of attention in the past month or so because it contained a list of names of physicians who performed abortions across the country. The stated goal of the site was to gather as much information as possible from whatever source, and it encouraged people encountering this website to give whatever information they had, right down to driver's license numbers and names of pet cats, for each of these physicians, with the stated goal of, once abortion becomes criminal and we actually go back to prosecute everybody who performed them, we'll have all the data on hand. But the net result, particularly since they were releasing all this information on the site as they got it, was to do something that would make, just as that person in the room that our caller from Canada was describing, was amazed to find these not particularly salacious details, but very personal details up there, it makes you feel wildly uncomfortable. And you can imagine somebody wanting to change their behavior just to make it go away.
Jason Catlett, thank you for joining us on The Connection.
Sure, thank you.
And we mean to stay in touch with Junk Busters. 1-800-423-8255 makes the Internet Privacy Connection with Jonathan Zittrain and Wendy Seltzer in our studio. They teach the course on Internet privacy at the Harvard Law School. It's a course that's taught only on the web, but you can join it there, and we'll tell you how. 1-800-423-8255 makes the connection. Chris is calling from Walpole, Massachusetts.
How you doing, Chris?
Good, Chris.
I don't even know where to begin here. I guess I've got a more moderate and I think a little bit more practical view than, say, Mr. Cavett. In defense of the Microsoft GUIDS, the globally unique identifier in office documents, the comment was made that people didn't know about this until 2 weeks ago. That's not true. I mean, lots of people have known about it for a long time, but it's not necessarily newsworthy. It's just kind of a practical thing. I mean, a Microsoft GUID, I mean, in defense of Microsoft, the Microsoft GUID is not some Orwellian thing. It's a unique, statistically unique number that's used all over Windows. It's not really a monitoring device per se.
The Orwellian dimension may be in the eye of the beholder, but go ahead, Chris.
Right. The fact is that every computer that has a network card in it has something called a MAC address. Now, this may have been spoken about earlier and I missed it, but a MAC address is a far more damning piece of information out on the network for tracking where you go and what you do than any identifier in a document. I mean, an identifier in a document can be forged. I mean, if you have something that you want to protect, there are ciphers and you should employ a cipher, but you shouldn't just rely on people's goodwill to protect your privacy if you have something to protect. I mean, I guess the question boils down to security is a complete thing, right? Any loopholes jeopardize your security. So if you don't buy everything in cash and you don't shred your mail before you throw it out, then, I mean,
that's asking the user of the technology to know a lot about what its potentials are and to know to guard themselves against the tracking of their documents by encrypting sensitive communications.
Well, I mean, isn't that just prudent practice, no matter what technology you use? I mean, when you post a letter, you assume it's secure by virtue of the fact that the post office says it is. But, you know, there are countless stories of mail workers that tamper with the mail. I mean, it's really just a question of your perspective. I mean, if you really have something to protect, then you need to understand what the system is you're using, no matter what the system is.
Part of the point of a computer is to make it easier for someone to communicate. And if we're saying now they have to go back and put in all of these safeguards each time they talk, doesn't that defeat the purpose of it?
Sure, it does. I mean, you know, I post to news groups occasionally, and if somebody was to search on my email address, they'd probably find out what type of pedals I like to use on my mountain bike, and I don't particularly care. Now, if I had something sensitive to post, then I certainly would take precautions. And, you know, people should just not assume glibly that everything that they write is anonymous. I mean, in most cases, it's highly useful to use the computer. And frankly, it's not of any particular importance if somebody intercepts it. I mean, the sheer volume of traffic makes it practically impossible to monitor everything everywhere all the time. And, you know, you're hiding in a sea. You're one grain of sand on a beach, really. I mean, if you have nothing to hide, then it's not a big deal, is it?
That's true enough. That's the famous argument that says, you know, hey, if you're not doing anything particularly wrong, what's the big deal? And so long as everybody is similarly exposed, aren't you still effectively anonymous? But of course, I guess Chris started the hour with the hypothetical of somebody who was suddenly, for whatever reason, thrust into prominence, and then not just the grain of sand, and then you actually go back with a fine-tooth comb and say,
"You're the grain of sand, suddenly."
Exactly. What do you know about this person? And I credit that there are...
I think knowing somebody's pedal preferences and mountain bikes is kind of the start of a lot of interesting insight. Chris, I'd be careful about that. 1-800-423-8255 makes the privacy on the Internet connection. Andy is calling from Pinter, Virginia.
Hey, Chris. A good show.
Morning, Andy. Thank you.
A lot of what was just said were some of the points I wanted to bring up, and that who's using the Internet and expecting that it's private anyway? And if somebody were involved in some unethical or unethical activity and using the net, wouldn't that give us cause to question how intelligent they were to be, say, serving on the Supreme Court in the first place?
Well, that's true, and in some way I take that as part of the deadbeat dad point that, you know, again, if you've got something to hide, we might as well get it out there.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you don't want people either walking around in a general state of paranoia, not knowing what can be found out about them, and not particularly having a clue as to what can be done. You know, here they're saying, oh, first I thought it was these GUIDs that I had to worry about. Now somebody's telling me about a Mac that I have to worry about. There's always something new to worry about. Now, those who actually follow it closely can follow it closely and know how to defend against invasions of their privacy. But for the 99.9% of the rest of us, having it be a default one way or the other that we don't have to actively defend against may be the order of the day.
Well, I don't suppose that most people walk around like chickens waiting for the sky to drop. And if they're using the Internet, they know that it's a pretty open field out there and everybody's visible. I don't think there is a paranoia except for those people that are involved in doing something illegal or unethical on the net. And maybe that's good for them to feel a little paranoid. Maybe they'll clean up their act a little bit.
I'd ask another positions listed on the Nuremberg Files website. Maybe
there are exceptions. I agree. I don't know that we should be pursuing such a proposing a massive you know, gathering of legal intelligence to address this issue, because of the few exceptions that are out there, there's always going to be some radical, you know, far-wing groups that are using the internet, and anybody else that is using the internet is aware of that. And the last point I wanted to bring up, it ties back in with a comment that was made by the previous caller about computers intending to make our life simple, and the more programs that we need to be installing on the computer, the more concerned that we need to be about our privacy. Everything's just expecting too much and making the computer a much more complicated tool than I believe it was intended to be. So that's all I wanted to say.
Andy, thank you. Thank you for joining us. 1-800-423-8255 makes the Internet Privacy Connection. Via is on the line.
Hi, I'm continuing in that same line, and I'll go even further. Isn't it good that we now have to be responsible? Doesn't that bring us back to the village or small town where indeed we had to be polite to our neighbors because otherwise our reputations would be ruined? Won't that make us more responsible?
Somebody, it reminds me of somebody's definition of conscience being right. that little dark suspicion in the back of your mind that somebody might be looking.
That you have to be responsible for what you're doing. And you can't just let go. The good old 60s is out of fashion. You have to be responsible. You can't just let it all hang out.
I don't know. I'm happier sort of supposing that somebody might be looking than having a real fear that somebody is looking. I think there's a big difference. I don't want to suppose that somebody might actually be listening into my phone conversations or reading my email, even though, you know, we've lived all our lives, we've said a million times, all of us, you know, in case the CIA is listening on the telephone.
But it's not so much the CIA and so on, but if it would just improve. I know that at the local supermarket where all my neighbors are standing around, I won't make a fuss because the cashier is slow or makes a mistake. But if I'm out where nobody knows me, I suddenly let go.
But even
the big country, as big as it has become, is being made smaller, or the world is being made smaller with the internet.
Even in the small town, though, there are times that you want to draw your shades and not have the neighbors looking in the window.
Correct. But when you draw your shades, you just don't write things on the internet that you don't want anyone else to read. You don't access those porn sites, at least not from your own computer. You go down to the local computer shop. You become a little more responsible, socially responsible. It sounds as if this might be an idea for the mayor of New York.
It is amazing because people who, getting just back to a bunch of lawyers, people who think about this constitutionally and worry about free speech, actually worry about the ability of people to indulge in, to say and to read incredibly unpopular views, views that the majority might find repugnant, repulsive, unethical, and a lot of people see that as actually important to a functioning polity, that people be able to dabble in those views even if ultimately they reject them. Now, I agree there's always a question of balance, and you want to have responsibility, and responsibility is grounded in having to stand behind what you do and what you say. But being able to cordon off a special place, I mean, drawing your blinds may not simply be for the purpose of indulging in pornography. It may be for all sorts of other reasons that are actually integral to a functioning constitutional democracy.
Via, thank you. Thank you for joining us. 1-800-423-8255. Warren is on the line.
Hello?
Hello, Warren.
Hi, Chris. Good show. Thanks.
Thanks for calling.
I want to quickly say hi to Jonathan. This is Warren Hodling.
Oh, Warren, how are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Good.
I wanted to inject sort of a little different take on the idea that there's something good or potentially something good in this erosion of privacy, not so much from the accountability point of view, but from a sort of a spiritual evolution point of view. I've been doing a lot of reading lately that's talking about the idea of transparency, where if I personally can give up the idea that I have something to hide, this is liberating for me. So I've done things that I'm not happy about. I've done quote-unquote bad things, but I don't believe that makes me a bad person and I shouldn't be tying up a lot of my energy and being ashamed of that. I think this is, of course, you have to be fully enlightened to really hold on to that all the time. But if we have technology that's, I mean, well, another way to spin this out in terms of things like the whole Bill and Monica Gay thing is, will there be a point at which we know everybody's dirty laundry so much that we finally realize it doesn't matter? Who cares? So that's, I wanted to sort of throw that into the mix, that not so much, it's not a good thing because I know who the deadbeat dads are, but maybe it'll help me and each individual person realize that we don't really have anything to hide in an important spiritual sense.
I think that's a great point, and it's a point that you'll see made increasingly as companies are being advised strategically about how they need to behave and change their behavior in a globally networked world in which they can't hide things. And for so long, companies have had this idea that the face they present inside to themselves as they discuss an issue can be completely unhinged from the face they present to the outside world once they make a decision. Actually getting them to see that the more you can integrate the two, let it hang out and hope not to be skewered for it, but to at least understand it's presenting your true face. Indeed, it's spiritually enlightening even for a company. Yeah. Then the question just is, should people be thrown into this swimming pool of enlightenment, or should they be left to enter nirvana on their own time?
Exactly, and that's actually the thing I wanted to follow up with. So for me, the issue with protecting people's privacy is not so much, it's a different one, it's respect. The fact is, I go and out somebody and say, oh, well, they did X, Y, and Z, that can be very hurtful to them because maybe they're not at a place where they can really know I'm still an okay person even though I did X, Y, and Z. So for me, the reason to respect people's privacy is respect for them and for who they are and for my desire not to cause them pain, not for the other reason like everybody should be hiding their little dark secrets. And then and connecting with that is people have brought up the issue about the Nuremberg file site. It seems to me that's a completely different issue than the GUID issue or the serial number on the new Pentium chip or whatever. That's not a case of spying going on. That's a case of collecting all this information in legitimate or illegitimate ways, but then putting it up there in a way that's encouraging bad behavior towards these people who are targeted. I mean, I really agree with the court decision that ruled against these people because, you know, whatever they say, the behavior that was encouraged was violence towards these people, and if not physical violence, at least emotional violence. So that gets back to, again, respecting the person. And then that also ties in with the talk about the free speech people being worried about unpopular views. I think that rather than having the unpopular view, person with the unpopular views having to hide behind anonymity, we should instead strive for a society where we protect the person's right to say, my name is Warren, here's my view, it's unpopular, and know that I'm not going to be damaged because the society will protect me.
Warren, it strikes me you're talking about kind of the benefits of mutually assured outing in which everybody will know everything bad. We will see the Bill Clinton, sort of the predatory, prurient side of everybody, and we'll know it's there all the time, and then we will somehow readjust our thinking and our feeling about folks to know that we're all flawed. Do you think that's a good thing?
No, not necessarily. I mean, I think that this is one of the, sort of an accidental, I'm talking about perhaps a potential forced spiritual evolution here. I mean, there has to be a real change in the way we think about, and the view that I have, that I'm espousing here, is not the popular view. I mean, I believe that, this is way out there to some people, there's no such thing as a bad person. A murderer is not a bad person.
Well, exactly, but we don't have God's view. God's view of his flawed creation, and he will see. We will know exactly how
spiritual evolution is moving towards God's view, in my opinion.
Right.
You know,
and God still loves us for all our flaws.
Yeah, and I mean, what I believe is that what we have to do is love ourselves. I mean, you know, the God that does this loving is inside. You know, this makes me sound like sort of a New Age, goody two shoes, whatever.
But that's right.
It's an in the trenches, everyday thing. You know, I'm not able to have positive relationships with people unless I can really get rid of all my crap that thinks I'm a bad person.
Hmm.
Well, it all gets turned on other people. I mean, I said,
you're a good guy and you're a good caller, Warren. Thank you. 1-800-423-8255. Jerry is on the line.
Hi.
Hello, Jerry.
How are you?
You're a good person, too.
Thank you.
Sorry. No matter what you wrote in your email.
Well, I came to this conversation, admittedly, not on the Internet. I have never been on the Internet. I've never wanted to be on the Internet. And, in fact, at the beginning of the show, I felt like I didn't want to ever get onto the Internet as I started to listen to what the kinds of things that people could find out about you. And to me, the conversation really misses the point in some way in talking about the political aspects of it and sort of like this social aspect. And really, to me, it's a lifestyle thing. I really agree with what was just said about the spiritual evolution, but I don't think that our society is there. And so what we have is a situation where, you know, to a large degree, a lot of this information is actually going to people who want to make money off of you. So you do stuff on the internet, and the guy who had the pedals, eventually you'll find people calling him up from bike shops, right, and writing him stuff in the mail and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that people's lives are changed inextricably by what's going on right now. So to the point now that what I experienced about life 30 years ago, the kind of life that I lived and the kind of life I thought I was going to be living 30 years hence, has evaporated.
Mm. Gary, listen, I want to ask Wendy Seltzer and Jonathan Zittrain in the last minute here, should we be pushing toward a notion of spiritual evolution in a transparent world where we can all see through each other's flaws and virtues with God's eye, or should we be scrambling to recover what little is left of our privacy out there? Wendy?
Well, I think there's a lot to be scared of in the small town where unpopular views unfortunately still are unpopular and make the people unpopular. I'd be afraid a loss of privacy would erode that even further.
Jonathan Zittrain.
Well, I see the benefit of the transparent society. I'd want to put in some pitch for hypocrisy, that actually, even though we can't reach the goals we say we want to meet, to be able to articulate them and say that we believe in them is at least some hope of moving in that direction.
I want to say you can continue this conversation online, http://cyber.law.harvard.edu/connection.html. Thank you, Jonathan Zittrain and Wendy Seltzer. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston.